So, things might go terribly, horribly wrong. We know it did for Alexander this morning. Terrible, horrible things could happen. We know as individuals what we have to look forward to: old age, sickness, and death. Like Woody Allen, we know we have to die, but we don't want to be there when it happens. Things might go terribly, horribly wrong. And how do we know this? Well, because terrible, horrible things have already happened. Let's review some of them: war, genocide, earthquakes, infectious outbreaks, death in childbirth, incest, rape. You get the drift. And to go even further, terrible, horrible things are happening right now. War, genocide, Ebola, starvation, incest, rape on campus, ISIS, domestic violence. Meanwhile, we sit in this room, and terrible, horrible things are not happening. At least I hope not. Not happening right now. Take a deep breath and realize that in this room, things are going pretty well. We're here. We're celebrating community. We're breathing. We're alive. We are living wonderfully privileged lives, more privileged than probably 6 billion other humans on the planet. And yet, we are anxious. We worry about paying the cell phone bill. What's happening with that noise in our car? Will our children get into college? How will we get the grocery shopping done and the house cleaned before company tonight? Why do we do this to ourselves? Well, it's because that's the way we're wired. We human beings are here today because our ancestors were afraid. There were bears or snakes or lions. The man 10 feet away might hit us on the head with a rock and take our food. There were good reasons why they survived. And we inherited their wiring. They survived because there were good reasons to be afraid. Humans survived. Our ancestors survived because they had excellent imaginations, which helped them to predict things like, is there a bear in the woods? So we ask ourselves continually, over and over, as a culture, as a nation, as an individual, what if? We are blessed and cursed now with the view of the whole planet to ask what if about. Many of these things we as individuals can do nothing about. And when we are unsuccessful, either at predicting or protecting each other from disaster, we feel hopeless, we feel helpless, we feel paralyzed. So we shut down and deny. We come up with reasons for what we can't do, even say there are things we shouldn't do, even when things are in our control. As human beings, we are good at being anxious and good at being blind. To penetrate our anxiety, to transcend our fears, we must first accept that this is the way it is. Our reality is uncertain. So, one path to dealing with all of this is developing something which we can call radical acceptance. In radical acceptance, you accept the reality of the situation. You stop dwelling on situations you have no control over. This was described by Tara Brach, who is a Unitarian Universalist Buddhist psychologist. That's a lot of hats to wear. She wrote a book called Radical Acceptance, and she taught us that radical acceptance is not resignation. It is not agreement. We don't resign ourselves and say, oh, nothing we can do anyway. Let's just shut down and avoid. Or it's not, yeah, well, you know, what are you going to do? Radical means root. And at our root, we come to accept reality. First, the internal reality of fear and uncertainty, the internal reality of our vulnerability, and we avoid denying and avoidance itself. We allow ourselves to open our minds and hearts to the truth within, because the truth is not only about fear, but also about courage. We open to fear so we can open to hope, to courage, to the willingness to see ourselves as larger than one small, anxious, fearful life. We open to our humanity, our compassion, and our love. According to Jack Kornfield, another Buddhist teacher, the starting point is this: to look directly at suffering, both the suffering in the world and the suffering in our own hearts and minds. This is the beginning of the teaching of the Buddha and the beginning of our own understanding of the problem of world peace. At this moment on our planet, there are hundreds of millions of people who are starving or malnourished. Hundreds of millions of people so impoverished that they have little or no shelter or clothing. Or they are sick with diseases that we don't know how to cure, but they cannot afford the medicine or do not have access to it. For us to begin to look directly at the situation is not a question of ceremony or religion. We have a mandate to look into the very deep way at the sorrow and suffering that exists now in our world, and to look at our own individual and collective relationship to it, to bear witness to it, to acknowledge it instead of running away. The suffering is so great that we do not want to. We close our minds, we close our hearts and our eyes. Opening ourselves to all aspects of experience is what is asked of us if we want to do something, if we want to make a change, if we want to make a difference. We must look at the world honestly, unflinchingly, and directly. And then look at ourselves and see the sorrow that is not just out there external, but also within ourselves. It is our own fear, prejudice, hatred, desire, anxiety. It is our own sorrow. We have to look at it and not run away. In opening ourselves to suffering, we discover that we connect with and listen to our own hearts. As Joanna Macy, a Buddhist environmentalist, states, the refusal to feel takes a toll. Not only is there an impoverishment of our emotional and sensory life, flowers are dimmer and less fragrant, our loves less ecstatic. But this psychic numbing also impedes our capacity to process and respond to information. The energy we use pushing down despair is diverted from more creative uses, depleting the resilience and imagination needed for fresh vision and strategies. Radical acceptance is about the power of truth. That is the power Gandhi called Satyagraha, the force of truth, and the force that he demonstrated in his own life. When India was partitioned, millions of people became refugees. Muslims and Hindus moved from one country to the other. There was horrible violence and rioting. And when that went on, Gandhi went to what was then East Pakistan, and he walked from village to village, asking people to stop the bloodshed. Then he fasted. He said he would take no more food until the violence and insanity stopped, even if it meant his own death. And the riots stopped. They stopped because of the power of truth, because of the power of love, because Gandhi cared about truth. It was something much greater than Gandhi, the person. This understanding is the source of incredible power and incredible energy. There is a story of a woman who was used to getting her own way. She became very ill. She was very angry about being ill and took it out on everyone around her. First, she took it out on her family, and their visits dwindled. She raged and abused her friends, and they stayed away. When the hospital staff came to help, she abused them horribly, using her tongue to damage. Her pain increased, and now she was alone. Alone with her fear, alone with her anger and rage, and finally alone with her pain. One night, alone in her room, suffering, she hit the core of that loneliness. She suffered so badly, she entered a darkness she had never traveled to before. And for the first time, she accepted her pain. And in her pain, she became aware of the pain of the woman in the next room, suffering from bone cancer. She became aware of a woman a block away who had just been punched by her boyfriend. She became aware of a woman in childbirth suffering without help in Calcutta. She became aware of a woman raped and attacked in the Congo. Her pain joined with the pain of all of those who were pain in the world. And she was no longer alone. She reached out in love to the world, and peace descended upon her. And while her pain did not go away, her suffering did. When the hospital staff came to tend her, she reached out to them in love and peace. Soon after, she became their favorite. The energy of love and peace drew in all that she had alienated. The truth of fear and anxiety and suffering is true for all of humanity. And one by one, we can transcend our own to accept another. We can see our role as individuals in the larger picture. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, lived through concentration camps in World War II, and that experience taught him that to transcend our anxiety and fear, we must create meaning. He tells the stories of camp members giving the last of their bread to another. The story of one evening when a member called the others outside to see a beautiful sunset. So the second thing after radical acceptance is the importance of creating meaning out of suffering. But it must be the right meaning. So there's the story of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. They go camping. And after sharing a good meal and a bottle of Chardonnay, they retire to their tent for the night. And about 3 a.m., Holmes nudges Watson and asks, "Watson, look up to the sky and tell me what you see." And Watson says, "I see millions of stars." Holmes asks, "And what does that tell you?" Watson replies, "Astronomically, it tells me there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, it tells me that Saturn is in Leo. Theologically, it tells me that God is great and we are small and insignificant. Horologically, it tells me it's about 3 a.m. Meteorologically, it tells me that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. What does it tell you, Holmes?" Holmes retorts, "Well, Watson, it tells me somebody stole our tent." So, the meaning we create must embrace both the external and the internal truth. We must transverse the boundaries of both self-compassion and compassion for others. Joanna Macy helps us recognize that the pain we create to the planet Earth and opens us to this larger picture. In her book, World as Lover, World as Self, she leads us through a picture of human evolution to where we are now. In the first movement, she says, our infancy as a species, we felt no separation from the natural world around us. Trees and rocks and plants surrounded us with a living presence as intimate and as pulsing as our own bodies. In that primal intimacy, we were one with the world as a child is one in a mother's womb. Then self-consciousness arose and gave us distance on our world. We needed that distance in order to make decisions and strategies, in order to measure, judge, and to monitor our judgments. With the emergence of free will, the fall out of the Garden of Eden, the second movement began, the lonely and heroic journey of the ego. Nowadays, yearning to reclaim a sense of wholeness, some of us tend to disparage that movement of separation from nature. But it brought us great gains for which we can be grateful. The distance and observing eye brought us tools of science and a priceless view of a vast, orderly intricacy of our world. Now, harvesting these gains, we are ready to return. The third movement begins. Having gained distance and sophistication of perceptions, we can return and recognize who we have been all along. Now it can dawn on us. We are our world knowing itself. We can relinquish our separateness. We can come home again and participate in our world in a more responsible and beautiful way than before. We are often given to false choices. The choices of self-examination and self-healing, or the choice of service to a larger cause. What we have learned is when we embrace the self, the part of us that is vulnerable, wounded, suffering, the part of us that is anxious and afraid, then we can embrace all of humanity, which is the same underneath the skin. We are all afraid and we ask, what if? What if we radically accept the truth of who we are? What if I use what I know about myself to help another? What if I use my own need for meaning, for purpose, to set a shining light, a beacon on the hill to move toward? In words paraphrased from Jack Kornfield, in the heart of each of us, a great potential exists for realizing truth, for experiencing wholeness, for going beyond the shell of ego. The problem is that we become too busy and lost in our own thinking that we lose our connection with our own true nature. If we look deeply, we discover that the wholeness of our being comes to know and express itself both as radical acceptance and through the sharing of ourselves with others. And the course, the meaning, becomes clear. We can relinquish our separateness. We can participate in our world, bringing what only we can uniquely bring to the world. As Unitarian Universalists, we embrace both paths, the one of healing and the one of service, and find that they are one and the same.